This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.
Yes, all right, well, we should get started so you guys can get out of here on time. Welcome. I was uncertain on a late Friday afternoon if anybody would show, so you have rewarded my effort by showing up, and thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Why don't we pray and we'll get rolling. God, thanks for a chance to be your servants. Lord, we pray that you would give us your heart for the people in the city. Lord, give us your mind on them too. How can we serve them better? How can we love them into your kingdom? Most importantly, how can we raise up a generation of leaders from the inner city community? Lord, that's a really big topic. Just pray that your spirit would give us some illumination on the thoughts that I've prepared, Lord. And if there's things that you want said that aren't here in this presentation, I pray that you bring them to mind. And thank you for these faithful souls who've stuck around on a Friday afternoon to listen. I pray that this would empower them in whatever ministries that they're involved in. I pray these things in your son's name. Amen. All right. Raising leaders in the inner city was the topic I was given. And some of you may have gone to James Brown's seminar this morning of the same title.
Yes.
So this will be quite a bit different, I'm assuming. If James did the same seminar I've heard him give in the past on that topic, we're going to look at things a little bit differently. My name is Scott Arnold. I'm the executive director of Central Ohio Youth for Christ, which is where I get my inner city ministry background. I work primarily with teens, or have historically, through a long journey. I ended up moving into the city, so I live there and participate in some of the principles of the Christian Community Development Association by relocating. At the same time, as part of Xenos, I also lead a home group in that community and help lead a sphere of home churches on the west side. So I've kind of got the perspective of adults and kids with more roots in kids, and some of the pictures and illustrations you'll see probably have a bias towards kids, but the principles that I want to talk about today I think are pretty much the same. Oops, you know what I did? I got the wrong presentation open. So let me get the right one open, otherwise you're just going to get the handout version. And here I thought I was all set up and prepared. There we go. That looks a little better. Yeah. Yeah, that'll help everything. Get you guys out of here at 6:30 on time. All right. Now, I want to start out with this question. Is there something different about urban people that makes leadership development with them different from everyone else? And to me, that's a pretty important question. When I was asked to do the seminar, the first reaction I have is, so why? Isn't raising leaders the same? What makes urban people different from suburban people that you have to have a completely separate seminar on that subject? And I think it's an important question to ask, and it's going to shape what we talk about today. If so, what is it? What is it that's different? And if not, then what are we doing in the seminar? Aren't the resources, the materials that you're getting in all the other seminars and in the plenary sessions in this conference 100% applicable to inner city folks? Then we don't need to be spending any more time. We're done. So that's kind of how I'm framing this question. And essentially, what I want to do with this seminar is kind of a spin-off that, but I want to start by saying that the common experience that I think that I hear and I have experienced is that it's harder, but not everybody's all that sure why. It's like, yeah, it does seem different, thus it warrants a seminar, but I'll bet if you asked a dozen people who are somewhat fluent in leadership development, so what is it that's different, they probably couldn't put their finger on it, and I think that's even true for people who do work with inner city folks. They know it's harder, but they can't say why. So that's really what I want to tackle today. My burden for this subject is I think that it is different. There is something that we can glean out of an analysis of the situation. And today, I feel like this is the number one burden that I have for the sphere of work that I oversee on the West Side, is that leadership development is the number one challenge that we face in growing ministry in the city. So this is no small topic to me, and I think it is. The answer to this question in my mind is yes, it is different. And then lastly, I want to take the rest of the seminar today and I want to carve it out this way so that I'm clear. I am not going to spend my time going over all the things that everyone else has been going over. In other words, how to raise leaders, how to disciple, how to build relationship, those are all things that these other seminars are covering still do apply. So this is not about reinventing the wheel. Instead, what I want to take our time and talk about the additional material, the additional accessories that you're not going to hear in there that are unique to this population, if that makes sense. And so in so doing, I'm going to skip a lot of things that I would include if this was a standalone seminar, not part of a bigger conference with the broader topic of leadership development. If I were just to go in and say raising urban leaders, I would spend a lot of time on how to disciple, how to invest relationally, things like that. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to ask you to understand that's assumed that those things apply. Instead, if that's the car, I'm going to spend all my time talking about how we customize the tail fin to make this puppy run better in the race working with urban folks. Okay, so that's the focus of what I want to talk about today. And the first place I want to go to is I want to talk about what doesn't work. What are some of the flawed strategies that are out there? And these are some things that I've experienced firsthand. I should also add this. This seminar, for me, is more coming out of my experience than my research. Now, you're going to see some stuff in here that comes out of research. But for me, this has been a hands-on, life-on-life, decade-long learning experience. And I don't have a book. I'm not selling anything. What I'm trying to give you is stuff that I know works because it's working. And I know what some of the issues are because I'm living there. And I know what isn't working because I've experienced it firsthand. And I want to talk a little bit about some of those because I think these are the places people typically go when it comes to urban ministry. And the first one I call skim the functional or compliant. Okay, that's where, and a lot of ministries fall into this. They come into the city, they identify the most functional group of people in the city, the top 5%, the top 3%, the ones that actually are functioning at a fairly decent level, or those who may not be functioning that well but are super compliant. They are willing to be ordered around and told what to do, and they'll just salute. And there is a certain segment of any population that's like that. Once they decide who those people are, then they apply what essentially is fear, threat, motivation. In biblical terms, it's legalism. You must do this or you will not have our approval. You can't do that. You better not be caught smoking. Christians don't smoke. You better not be caught doing this. Cussing, that is out. I can't believe I heard you cuss. Don't you ever do that. And so the list of things that you shouldn't be doing is applied legalistically. Most of those kids that stop doing those things have no idea why they should stop doing them. They're not engaged on a soul level of life transformation. This isn't emerging from an understanding of Christ that transformed me and caused me to think, hey, maybe I shouldn't do that. Instead, it's purely, those are the rules in our youth group, or those are the rules in our ministry, and if you want to succeed here, or you want to participate here, or you don't want to get thrown out here, then you better stop doing those things. And that's the message that's communicated. Well, in my experience, about 70% of the kids in the city is going to give you the finger and walk. Mm-hmm. And about 10 or 20% at the most will hang into that kind of ministry, and then eventually even those get winnowed down fairly quickly. And so you end up with some poster child of ministry that really is more about socialization through legalism than it's about transformed lives. And I've seen this over and over again. It's an unfortunate phenomenon for a lot of reasons that we don't have time to get into here. But most of the focus is on outward behavior. And this is the rub, is that ministries that do this frequently ignore the long-term fruit of this approach. Those leaders, those young people that come out of ministries like this frequently are the ones who fall in their 20s with some girl in the ministry, or who go off and leave the faith at age 28. Why? Because the thing that was keeping them following Jesus was fear, right? Not a transformed soul.
Someone else's fear, right?
Right.
Someone else driving them, right?
The fear of someone else censuring them if they don't comply. And so that external pressure, A, only lasts as long as that other person is there. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the socialization sticks for a while, but if there isn't true inner transformation, the pull back towards behaviors that they may have escaped, or, and this is also a common experience, the behaviors they've been doing all along but had managed to learn how to keep secret. And so what you see frequently are an incredibly broad array of double lives being led, which is unfortunately the common effect of legalism.
So it sounds like they have to take ownership over their stuff with God and work with God to transform. Otherwise, this model just will completely fall on its face.
Right. Well, over time.
Yeah.
Over time. Like I said, in the short term, you don't see this. You do a longitudinal study of people, and frankly, here's one of the interesting things about ministry in the city, and I found this out real quick. You can lead kids to Christ, you can lead people to Christ by the busloads in the inner city. You can't lead people to Christ in the inner city, you're just not that good at ministry. Okay, that's the easy part. The hard part is having them walk with Christ. Okay, and I can tell you that as I've got into the inner city, one of the things I found frequently was, you know, someone would come to Christ and everybody would be like, oh, yeah, well, you know, Aunt Bethel got Jesus a couple years back too, but, you know, a couple weeks had passed. Everybody has a story of someone coming to Christ in their family who was an alcoholic or a drug addict or this or that, and in very short order reverted right back to the same old way of living. And so in many ways, the Christian gospel in the city, that at least to the populations I've been exposed to, is almost passé. It's viewed as someone that got religion, but we all know it doesn't really work. It's just a scam. That Jesus is really going to help you change your life is a scam, and if you just give it time, that'll prove itself out. So the cynicism that invades the community about faith is tangible, and it has to do with this. We're not able to produce long-term systemic change in people. We won't be able to raise leaders that last. And that's the only thing that's going to reverse that cynicism. The city's filled with broken people who got Jesus and never went anywhere. Okay? This is a citation from Galatians chapter 6. Paul here is talking about a very similar situation. In the book of Galatians, of course, the basic premise is some folks coming from a Jewish background were adding to the gospel the rules of Judaism in order to get Paul's converts in the Galatian churches to conform with their understanding of how people should act. He says this: those who are trying to force you to be circumcised are doing it for just one reason. They don't want to be persecuted for teaching that the cross of Christ alone can save. And even those who advocate circumcision don't really keep the whole law. They only want you to be circumcised so they can brag about you and claim you as their disciples. This is painful to read. I would hope to say that the people that I've run across that have done ministry this way, this isn't their motive. However, I have personally experienced what it's like to have disciples, and I might even want to put quotations around the term disciples, who lower the lowest bar possible for the term disciple in any crowd. And the sinking feeling of embarrassment over my disciples' behaviors. I can recall, for example, going to the Billy Graham Crusade. What was that? 8-9 years ago, something like that now? Long time ago. I guess I'm getting old. So here I am. I got my disciples from my inner city ministry out to Billy Graham Crusade. For me, that was like a huge win that these kids would even come to something like that, right? And this other guy that I knew in ministry had, he was a high school ministry guy. He had his disciples sitting in the row in front of me, right? Well, my kids are back there talking about getting laid and smoking crack and using the F word nonstop. They're not even listening to Billy Graham. His kids, on the other hand, are sitting there quietly nodding, wow. And several of them went up and got saved out of his group. And I'm just sitting here thinking, you know, why me? What have I done to deserve this as a ministry? Because it's not like I haven't tried with these kids and I haven't worked with these kids. And so there is, and it over time happens that people see the kids that you're working with and they're like, they're not behaving the way they should. I can't tell you how many times I've had people take a run at me about the fact that kids can cuss at our meeting. I'm under another round of it right now as I speak. And it was caused by someone who came into our ministry, visited, was all offended, and is now talking to people who are talking to people. And I've got a board member of my organization who's coming at me with, you know, you have people cussing and stuff. You know, the problem with that is that these kids that he was hearing cussing aren't even Christians. So what am I supposed to put a no cussing? If you're not a Christian, then leave anyway because you cuss? I mean, at the lowest level of behavior, this is, I mean, these kids, I wish they would stop selling crack first and then maybe deal with the cussing issue later. So there is this sense of our picture of what a Christian kid ought to be. And when we don't have that happening, we feel this pressure that either to be embarrassed about my disciples, or if I got the kid that fits the picture, then I can brag about that kid. Yeah, look at how great my ministry is. And I don't think that it necessarily starts out as an evil motive. I think it starts out as, I, like anybody else, if I build buildings, I want to build a building everybody looks at and says, that's a great building. And if I'm doing discipleship ministry, I want my disciples to be someone people look at and say, wow, that's a great disciple. And what happens if I'm starting with kids who on their best day are way further behind than a lot of other disciples? That's where you get into this pinch point. And those who revert to this approach begin to point and put pressure on, no, you can't behave this way, and if you're in ministry, your ministry shouldn't act this way. We've got to think this through and be able to push back at this, and I'll talk about that a little bit more at the end, and I'm also going to talk a little bit in more depth about this. So we're just kind of opening up a can of worms we're going to come back to. Here's a second flawed strategy. Extract them and resocialize. We pull them out of their urban context. We put them into a group where they're the small fish in a big pond, and through socialization pressure, we get them to act the way and think the way we want them to think and act in a way that we're more comfortable with, which is great. Except they're really not a leader anymore in the culture they came from, because they're not of that culture anymore. And so you can see this, and you can even do this with ministries that are vital ministries doing great discipleship. But in so doing, take the kid out of the place where he can be a leader in his indigenous population, because you've essentially re-socialized him. Well, we can also do this. I've seen this. Lower the bar and ignore the results. Let's just expect less. I mean, after all, these people in the city, they've got extra problems, and we just have to understand. And so I guess we just can't expect as much out of them. Well, I don't agree with that either. I think that has all kinds of long-term implications. The biggest one being that doesn't last very long. Because as soon as you start multiplying leaders who really aren't capable of leading, it doesn't take very long at all before you got more problems than you got time to, you know, to put out the fires on. And your ministry will grind to a halt because you cannot build. You can only build what you've got enough fire hose to manage time-wise, and then you spend the rest of your ministry time putting out fires. I don't think this is the way to go, and people get hurt in the process. The last one is assume that there is no difference between the city, and I'm guilty of that, which is why I put it on there. And I don't know if I would say, maybe I should have rewritten that, not assume, but I at least postulated that. When I first started in inner city work, I asked the question I asked at the beginning, so what is different? And I didn't feel like I really got very satisfying answers, and so I decided, well, hey, I'll just apply what I know works elsewhere, and until the day that it doesn't. And so after 4 or 5 years, I wizened up and cried uncle and said, all right, I get it. It is different. But this, just assuming that there's no difference in plowing ahead, you're just pouring some extra time of your life down a hole on the learning curve. Take it from me. It's different. Let's talk about some of the reasons why. Okay, understanding the challenge. The challenge really, in my mind, goes all the way to this question. How do we view biblical ministry? Is it primarily spiritual and moral growth? Is that what ministry is? Our goal is to get people to be spiritual and act morally. Know their Bible, be able to share the gospel. There you go. Is that the deal? Or does it include social components? The church in America, of course, split over that issue back in the early part of the 1900s. Thus, you have the social ministry movement, or the social gospel, and you have the evangelical movement, or it started out being the fundamentalist movement, and then out of that came the evangelical movement. The point being that the social gospel advocates, typically being theologically liberal, have kind of been at war with those who preach the gospel and have held to orthodox doctrine. And as a result, this huge rift has existed, and many people would say no. That's a nice thing, but it's not really what ministry is all about. This, preaching the word, going to Bible studies, discipling, making disciples, that's what it's about. Getting involved in the social needs of a community, not really that important. And it even sounds kind of liberal anyway. So, you know, we have, and I've seen this a lot in churches, you know, we have a food pantry in our church, or that goes this way. Yeah, we're in a social ministry, we have a food pantry. And you're like, really? Yeah, it's over there down the hallway. And I've actually, a couple churches come to mind as I say this. You go down the hallway, and, you know, up at a shelf about this high and a shelf about that wide, you know, 4 feet wide and about 2.5 feet tall, where you can barely get to it, you got to get on a stool, is about 15 cans of, you know, Campbell's soup and some saltines and some corn and some things like that. Yeah, there you go, and there's our social ministry. And you're like, I'm not sure that's what I had in mind. So does the gospel really include both social components and evangelical ones? I have been on a journey with this challenge. This was the crux of my struggle. Because I look at this kind of stuff, I came from a background that says, that may have a place for ministry to the poor or social need, but that was really poorly defined. It wasn't, a compelling case wasn't made to me about how my theology interacted with social needs. And so I got into this, and the one thing that I saw with urban ministries, and as I went out and looked at other urban ministries, I saw there is this tendency for social ministry to be a black hole. I mean, you can do a gazillion different programs in the area of social ministry. You could spend all of your time, all of your money, all of your energy doing social needs in a community. Where does it stop? And as I asked people to answer that question for me, where do you think it stops? I couldn't get good answers. And because I couldn't get good answers, it felt like, gosh, do I want to, you know, drive my boat up right next to this big black hole everything else is pouring into, and just be sucked into the vortex and never return? Now, and I lose the evangelical component of what I'm about? Not because my faith is gone, but because all my energy and time is being sucked into doing social activities? So what I did is I charted a course and I said, I'm going to focus instead on sharing the gospel, doing evangelism, doing personal discipleship, and I'm going to stay that course until I'm confident that I can't raise leaders doing that. And after about 4 years, I said uncle on that. Take an example of a young person in my neighborhood. There's a 60% dropout rate in my neighborhood. What happens when they've dropped out of school? They have little to no job skills. Their girlfriend gets pregnant, or they get a car, or they need money for something, and their only source of income is maybe to get a part-time job flipping burgers at McDonald's. Or the one thing they kind of know is, hey, they can go out and sell drugs and turn a grand in a day. What do you think they're going to do? Their economic need drives them to make decisions to go sell some drugs. I'm not saying that's right. I'm saying that's what happens. Okay, now, how is your disciple going to remain a walking disciple and be a drug dealer at the same time? I mean, at first they may just do it and try to pretend, but over time, the internal pressure, the accusation of Satan, and the personal sense of, this, you know, what am I doing that for, will keep coming up. When they bought into selling drugs, they're probably going to drop out of your discipleship group and you'll never see them again. So social needs very much were critical to us being able to raise disciples. And I could give you a whole list of other examples. That's just one, and I'm not trying to pick on drug sales as much as I'm trying to say it's just part of the fabric and economy of the inner city. And so there are ways to make, I mean, there was a kid that I knew that was making $2,000 a day as a middle schooler selling drugs. So is that kid or any other kid like that going to be pumped about flipping burgers at McDonald's for $7 an hour as a life career? Maybe when they're young, but as they get older and have real economic needs, social issues drive them the other way. Here's a quote that I really like. This guy was a missionary, and he makes this quote. The social gospel divorced from personal salvation is like a body without a soul. And the message of personal salvation without a social dimension is like a soul without a body. The former is a corpse, and the latter is a ghost. And I think the problem is we shouldn't have to choose between one or the other. That's the problem. Our theology has to incorporate both, and I believe that's biblical. And the more I've been walking down this journey, the more convinced that I am that it is, and I'm also convinced that it is the core to understanding the issue of urban ministry and the solutions to urban ministry. For example, let's take a look at 1 Timothy 3. Here we talk about leadership from a biblical perspective. For an elder must be a man whose life cannot be spoken against. He must be faithful to his wife. He must exhibit self-control, live wisely, have a good reputation. He must enjoy having guests in his home and must be able to teach. You know, how could you enjoy having guests in your home if you're homeless? You ever thought about that? And if as we go through here, think about it this way. If you're economically poor, if you don't have the skills to get a good job or hold a job, if you don't have good health, you got serious health issues, if you have fractured relationships, how can you do these things? You can't. He must not be a heavy drinker or be violent. He must be gentle, peace-loving, and not one who loves money. He must manage his own family well with children who respect and obey him. For man cannot manage his own household. How can he take care of God's church? How could you be a good manager of God's church if you can't manage your home well? How can you manage your home well if your economic issues are completely out of control? Or your relational skills are in the toilet? Or if you have a long-standing inability to work well in a social environment or a community environment? And on it goes. There's implied competence in the social areas of our life in that list, is my point. If there weren't, he would just say, an elder must be a man who knows his Bible really well and can teach it really well and is very moral. Well, what difference does it make if we wrestle with this issue of theology? Let's look at it this way. Suppose I have two people I led to Christ. In this little chart, I got person A. This person comes from the suburbs, from a fairly adjusted, well-adjusted, normal American life. Person B comes from the city. Both these people came to Jesus recently. They have some basic understanding of the gospel. They've been to a couple Bible studies. And we're saying to them, if you want to be a leader around here, here's the level of competence and spiritual understanding that you really need. This is the way that the presentation typically goes. So if I'm working with person B and you're working with person A, I'm like, okay, well, I got this big of a gap to go, and gosh, you got the same. So really, we got about the same task set out before us, right? However, what if we had more of a holistic picture of ministry? What if, and these categories I'm going to come back to later are part of the model that you have as a handout. What if we felt like both spiritual and moral is one category, relationship building is a second, economic is the third, health and safety a fourth, civic fifth, and education a sixth? What if we thought those were all critical components of a biblical ministry model? And these two people netted out like that. And now we say, okay, here's the leadership goal. Who's going to get there quicker? Well, that's a no-brainer. Here we got, most suburban folks graduate high school. A lot of them go to college and even grad school. Like I said, in my neighborhood, there's a 60% dropout rate. And that's not just for kids. If you do the demographics from 15-year-olds through 80-year-olds, you take any slice of that, it's about the same. So this is a generational problem. Most of them aren't graduating even high school. Okay.
You talk about just the people or the people?
Okay. People. I'm saying the pool from which we draw our ministry. And unless we're going to go after that 40%, again, go back to the skimming across the off-the-top principle, unless we're just going to go find the ones that did and ignore the rest, if we're going to pull demographically from the whole community, then our ministry ought to reflect that 60-40 divide. And unless I'm going to just skim off my leadership as just the ones who are socially well-adapted, I'm going to get some folks in my ministry who haven't even graduated high school, who can't read, who can't write, who may have incredible gifting and ability and calling by God, but don't have that skill. Okay? How is that person ever going to be a leader if they don't learn how to read and write? That's the gap that they're going to experience.
But you can make the same case for a person in a white neighborhood that has a high school education, but he's trying to reach out to and become a leader, and there's all college education people here. So if these people, if you get one person in an urban city that does have a high school education, maybe this person that thinks is older, 14 years old, won't drop out of high school because their role model is this high school. Mm-hmm. And that might not be the best role model, but it's better than what you said in the.
Well, certainly I'm not suggesting that you can't be a role model, but I'm looking at leadership a little different. I'm suggesting that leadership is a role of responsibility, that there's kind of a bar that's pretty much out there that you want to see most of your people at. We'll come back and talk about that in a few minutes, because that's a really important point, and that is part of what I want to address. I'm going to argue that to say because it's an urban neighborhood we lower this bar, that again, it's a problem.
Are you saying that's wrong?
I'm saying that it will catch up to you. It's not the better strategy. I'm not going to say it's morally wrong. I'm just going to say it's unstrategic.
Could I also read into this then, since we are looking at some differences, that we know that these are differences that we have to overcome as part of our outreach and leadership development?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Absolutely. Right. And that is exactly what I'm saying. I'm saying, for me, civic... And again, I'm not going to break down all these terms, but I gave you a handout that explained them. Part of my model, part of civic is the ability to resolve conflict.
Yes.
People in the city have a very much lower capacity to handle an insult and have completely different skills about how they resolve that conflict, typically, than people in suburbia. Okay? So... you can't have your preacher, well, like the movie The Apostle. Did you see the movie The Apostle? Where they're in the middle of the sermon and some guy comes to the church. And has anybody seen this?
Yeah.
It's really great. So this guy comes to the church and is being a little rowdy. So the preacher goes, hang on just a minute, walks down to the middle of the church, takes this guy out and just wails the ever-loving snot out of him out in the field, comes back in, straightens his tie up, and goes back to preaching.
Yeah.
You know? There's a problem with that.
Right.
There's a problem with that. I think we have to have the bar a little higher than that. Okay? And so... if that's your approach to conflict resolution, you got to grow through that. You can't just say, well, in the city, I guess that's okay. It's not. Health and safety, there's probably a similar percentage of people with health issues in all communities, but in the city, what I see is people treat them less well, frequently don't have insurance, frequently. Now, it's ironic because sometimes they also get free medical in because of that, but then on the triple irony is they don't access it. I could give you a long list of examples of people that I know that have major health issues that their family just doesn't address it. I remember one kid, and it wasn't a big deal, but it was such an obvious deal, but he had broken the little plastic pad on his nose piece on his glasses off, so all he had was this metal prong sticking down, and so over a period of a month or 2 months, that metal prong drilled a hole into his nose. I mean, all the way through to his nasal cavity. Because that was the only glasses he had. He needed his glasses to read. And so he wore his glasses. And so finally, I said to one of my staff people, I was just like, this is ridiculous. Take him, we got to take him somewhere and get this fixed. Yeah. So we looked into it. Well, here it turns out they had free medical, and that included the free optical. And he could have gotten it fixed any time at no charge whatsoever. So we began to push, well, get your mom to take you. Well, another 1 month went by, and it was obvious she wasn't going to. It wasn't bothering her, and he wasn't going to die over it, so she didn't care. And so it wasn't until we put him in the car and took him ourselves and got her to sign the permission slip in advance for us to go and get him treated that he got his glasses fixed. Okay? Well, that's a minor example. But I could give you other examples of safety issues kids deal with in the city, safety issues in the home, safety issues at school. Young adult safety issues are big. Being raped and molested with girls is a big issue. I know a lot of girls that put the locks on the inside of their bedroom doors to keep mom's boyfriend out at night. You know, that's an environment that they're growing up in. And if some of that kind of stuff is going on, if they're being beaten up or beaten down, they're distracted from growing spiritually and being all about God. And there's some implications for their view of God, too. I lost one kid out of a walking relationship with Christ because he went back to Satanism. Because he was a small kid and he was put into a group home, and we lost him through the system. And in that group home, there's this little shrimpy short guy who felt defenseless, and if he was a Satanist, then he could cast spells and people would be afraid of him, and so they wouldn't mess with him. But if he was a Christian, then he got beat up all the time. And so he opted for Satan because he felt safe, or safer, by being a Satanist. Health and safety issues are there in ways that you just don't think of until you get into the mix with some of these folks. And it's not just kids. The same happens with adults. It's amazing to me how many battered women there are in the city who are afraid to do anything about it. And so if your disciple has got major issues of being battered, what are you going to do about that? You're going to encourage her to leave her non-believing husband because she's being battered? Great. Now you got all kinds of economic issues to deal with that you're going to have to walk through with her. Okay. Not that that's not normal, and probably you still should do it. Point being is you're going to have to deal with this. You're going to have to deal with this. And this still has to be done too. And the point in all this is just to say these are the challenges that you face in working with urban communities. I'm going to come back to this a little later again, but I want to make a point that in my mind, the number one challenge in the inner city is not economic. It's relational. And I've got years of experience and a lot of research to back that up. I'm not saying that, you know, I'm God on this, but I am dead convinced that is the source of most of the dysfunction that you see in these other areas in the city. And most people mistakenly think it's economic.
Yeah, it's coping, basically. You know, how do you deal with the challenges, the ups and downs, but also with each other? Does that sound...
Well, you have... What you have, for example, a lot of the kids that we see... And I could go the other way and talk about all the adults that we work with. The adults we work with more often than not grew up without a dad. And they got all these problems which land them in the city, but then you start, well, okay, there was no dad in the home, which is frequent. Mom, addicted to crack, not around. Okay? We deal with kids who have their identity stolen by their parents and or guardians in order to open up new telephone numbers or, you know, I got my phone cut off because I didn't pay my bill. And they won't open up a new phone until I pay it, and I don't have the money, but I want a phone, so I use my kid's social security number to create a fake ID to be able to open up a new telephone under a new name so I can get a telephone again, which is great right up until my kid turns 18 and discovers their credit's trash because I did that with their phone, and I did it with the water company, I did it with this, and I did it with all of my kids, and so when they turn 18, they find out their credit's trashed. When you get young people... And again, I don't want to too much focus this on youth, but this plays out in adulthood. When you get young people who don't see any adult in their life or very few adults in their life who do anything but take advantage of them, they don't trust anybody. And trust, if you don't have the capacity to trust, that opens up a whole other can of worms. Okay? Everybody's out to get you. How far will you get in life if you think everybody's out to get you? That will play out in all kinds of ways. It's a belief that comes from distrust, and I'll tell you, that is a huge issue with most of the kids we work with, and it plays into adulthood. It's not just kids. You see, urban people do not trust most people, and they feel like they've been abused and taken advantage of by most people, and therefore, no one's got their back, and that has all kinds of implications for then their ability to get a job and feel like anything that happens at work, they're probably getting ripped off. Great example. I got a buddy that owns a company. He hired a guy. This guy had been in prison, came from an inner city neighborhood, been in prison, got out, couldn't get a job. My buddy gave him a job. All right? Good Samaritan that he is. So he took him in. The guy worked for a week, got his paycheck, saw on his paycheck that all these deductions for FICA, FICA, and all this stuff, He marched into my buddy's office, cursed him for stealing from him, and walked out the door, never to be seen again, before my buddy could even explain that these are taxes and everybody pays them. Okay? Well, he burnt that bridge so deeply. Why? Because there was absolutely no opportunity in his mind to give any benefit of the doubt. He got ripped off. There you go. Bad conflict resolution skills. The whole thing melted down, and you know, now he's and getting a job as an ex-con is pretty tough as it is, and he blew a really choice opportunity to do that.
Well,
so
then they
would understand that. Yeah, that's a whole different conversation.
Wow.
Just
to clarify, on the relational, is the relational between you and them or within the urban?
No, what I'm saying is that the urban community as a whole, between families, between neighbors, between extended family, more often than not, it's very, 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 very seldom, if ever, that you run across a family that doesn't have serious things going on in the family that completely destroy trust. Okay? And I could just I'd go around the room with my kids and I could give you the stories.
I understand that.
And
and
you know what? Yeah, and here's the thing. A lot of us grew up in, I grew up in suburbia. I used to think, you know, my parents fought all the time and my dad was this and then I had all these problems and I had a lousy set of parents and they didn't teach me anything about relating because they, my dad said to my mom right there, I hate you and I hate the kids and I don't want anything to do with you. And that was my family upbringing. It was pretty dysfunctional. I used to think, man, I got a really dysfunctional family compared to most people I knew it was. After doing urban ministry for 10 years, I can tell you, praise God for the family I had. You just don't understand it till you understand it. When you get into it, you begin to realize just how weird some of the things that go on in some of these families. And it's not one in a million or two in a million. It's most of them. They're different issues, but I can't tell you how many kids that I know that I know kids have been adopted and thrown back. What does that feel like? Because they were raised by a crack mama, taken by the system, adopted by people who decided they were just too much of a handful and gave them back to the county. I know one kid that happened to twice. What does that do to you relationally? How about the kid that gets, mom has a boyfriend that's molesting the girls, and it comes to light, and Children's Services show up and says to mom, either the guy goes or we're taking your kids. And mom says, well, you can have the kids. So your own mama chooses the molester over you. What does that feel like?
What value do you have?
It's so twisted, it's just hard to put, it's hard to get your mind around until you've walked in it. But when you begin to walk in it, you realize this is a huge, huge issue. And it is driving why those kids act out. They are in rage. Most of them have huge rage that carries with them all the way into adulthood and beyond. Why is it that people fight the way they do and get drunk the way they do and use drugs the way they do? Because they're escaping, because they're raging. Why do they have a hard time holding a job? Because they're raging. Why do they have a hard time passing school? Because they're completely distracted about rage and about issues going on in the home and all the other crap that's happened and the fact they didn't get a meal. Well, now we're feeding meals to the kids in the city to make sure they get a breakfast before they go to school. But there's big issues going on. You got older kids being parents for younger kids. We got kids that are parenting their parents. They're, you know, they take care of making sure there's food for their siblings because their parents don't. How do those things play out economically? I dropped out of school because I had to get money to help feed my brothers and sisters. I dropped out of school. I got a girl dropped out of school because her mom was in jail. Her grandfather was wanting to molest her. So she had a choice. She could go with her sister and brother, but they lived away from her school. And when she lived with them, they wouldn't put her in school because they wanted her to stay home to watch the kids, which is what she was required to do to pay them back for taking her in. She had to earn her own way. So their way is having her babysit their kids as a way to earn her way in their home. Therefore, she couldn't be in school because she was babysitting. Okay? So what does that say to a kid? Nobody cares about me, and nobody has my back. And the only way I'm going to get anything I need in this life is to trust nobody. And again, these things play out, they intersect all over the place, but it's relationship. It's the lack of feeling loved. It's the lack of trusting anyone. It's the lack of believing that anyone has my back. Anybody would do anything for me without there being something on the backside they're going to get out of it. It creates cynicism. It creates alienation. It creates suspicion. It destroys their ability to have a healthy marriage. And then the cycle, that just adds more confirmation that nobody loves them after they go through a divorce. And it just, the cycle just spirals downward. And then they move to drugs. They move to alcohol. They move to other things to numb the pain. These things all interact. And if we spend all of our time over here doing this, we are missing it. So, when it comes to, back up to the rabbit trail to raising leaders, that's why it's hard. Is that making sense?
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's why it's hard, and it has lots of other implications as well. Second topic, and I need to check my time here. 4:30, I got to get rolling. Differentiating social capital and spiritual growth. This is something that I got into as I began to disciple urban folks. Why is this an issue? Let's take, if I went back to that slide before, let's say that I had those person A and person B. Both get saved at the same time. Person A, after 6 months of being in Bible study, meeting with their discipler, taking a few classes around here, we're going to put them in charge of a Bible study because they're really happening. I mean, they got it together. They're loving Jesus. They reached out to their neighbors, got a couple people saved. This is really great. It's all really happening. My disciple, on the other hand, I've had around for 4 years now. They stopped selling crack, and they got a job. And it's not a great job because they don't have a high education, but they're working hard. They show up every day. They had a baby out of wedlock. And the good news was they got married, and so now they have a stable home. Bad news is that now they're a breadwinner working at a minimum wage job, and so they're working all the time, extra hours at whatever they can get. They can't go very far and drive because they don't have money for gas, and they certainly don't have money to pay for classes and stuff. Dropped out of school, so there's not that good of a reading ability. There is ability to read, but not that great of ability, and I'm thinking of someone in particular while I list these things off, okay? So now my person, after 3 or 4 years, let's say they got married, they become a stable father, they got a job, they've worked their way painfully through 3 or 4 books to try to read some things and learn some things. Meanwhile, this other brother, they became a disciple and a leader in 6 months. It's tempting to look at the one and say, well, this brother became a home church leader in 6 months or a cell group leader in 6 months. Man, they are just hot for God. This is like a really spiritual giant here. And look at this other poor schmuck that's been laboring for years and in some cases making major decisions like forgiving their parent for molesting them and dealing with all the crap and baggage from their past that they've faithfully chugged through, made decisions that I know are the right decisions to call on them to make, and even as they make them, I'm just amazed. It's a miracle of God this person was willing to do that. And I'm thinking to myself, man, this person has made decisions to follow God that this brother A over here hasn't even ever squared up to. But brother A is the one that gets touted as the great Christian leader and worker and loves hot for God, and my person, B, is looked at as, you know, well, yeah, they're in the church and everything. What happens is we can confuse social capital with spiritual maturity. And we can look at people who have made huge steps of growth as immature, and people who have made relatively minor, by comparison, steps of growth as mature. And in so doing, we really discourage the people who are coming from the deficit, if that makes sense. And that's another problem that you get into in raising leaders in the city. Is because you're going to have to deal with all these other issues in their life, it's going to be slower, it's going to be harder, and other people will seem to come and blow by them effortlessly, and that is really discouraging for them. Yeah.
I think the one word to separate A and B is that A has not made any sacrifices, and B, because he's done what he's always done. He was given a task, he did the task, and he's there. B has made sacrifice after sacrifice after sacrifice, turning back generations of a cycle
mm-hmm.
that just keeps growing and growing and growing.
Right.
And yet, you know, when you look at him on a chart, you say, well, A is our hero. Let's, you know, give him a gold ribbon.
Okay. Great. I'm glad that you said that, because that's exactly how I've felt at times. And at times even been really angry about it. Here's this person I've seen made all this growth and nobody even acknowledges they exist. And that really ticks me off. This isn't fair. However, I've come full circle on this. And here's why. You know, the person that is raised to go to school still made all the effort to show up every day, do their homework. They probably had 1,500 fights with their parents about doing your homework again. Okay, the kid that didn't do his homework is now in deficit, yes. But it's not like the kid that did do his homework made no sacrifices. The difference is he made those sacrifices incrementally through a lifestyle and years and years and years of incremental choices in his rearing or her rearing or their choices in life. And so they have made all those choices. And it's not fair to disparage them because it's, like, you've done something wrong because you grew up in a home that encouraged education. Or how dare you, you know, have a good job that pays well? That you figured out how to do that, that really rankles me because this brother over here doesn't have that. And he has no skills and all he can get is minimum wage job. You know, that you've done something wrong. Actually, he probably worked really hard to get to a place where he could do that. And so that's a rub for the discipler and for the disciple to deal with. It's a reality. I think the mistake, and I've made it, is to walk down the path of anger and frustration that those with who are saved with a huge amount of social capital already and therefore may only need for the focus to be on their spiritual and moral area, that somehow that's just wrong. No, really, it's great, and praise God for them, and the fact that my disciple is a minus 100 when they started, they're in the hole on all these areas, isn't that other person's fault? And I can't join them in being angry at that person or jealous of what they have. I have to take my person through the process of saying, God will honor the struggle that you're experiencing, and God will use the struggle that you're experiencing in mighty ways. And let's hope God can use this other person who has all these things, assets already, in mighty ways too. And let's not get into comparing. Okay? Otherwise, it can get really hard. But if you're raising disciples and leaders, you will face that issue.
And I think one of the tough things, especially when you're trying to grow from a deficit, is just it can be so emotionally draining, even though you know you're growing, you're moving forward, and you see the dissonance, the difference,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I've got to grow despite this, but that's, at least I'm growing.
Right.
I know that's what took me for me to keep moving forward with the deficits I had, which was I'm still growing and moving forward and moving forward. It is tough to watch the others.
Mm-hmm.
It really is, but yeah.
Well, and as leaders, we also have to be aware, do we set up structures that compare these two side by side? Okay, because I can cite, for example, within our structure here, that when I used to bring up some of our workers and leaders to the what we have here, what we call harvest meetings, and you'd see group after group after group, you know, oh, Sally, she came to Christ, you know, last year, and 6 months later she had a cell group, and now we're planning her home group 1 year later, and Johnny here, he's 18, but he's planted 2 home groups already, and you're just like, oh, I'm screwed. I mean, our whole team would go home depressed from those experiences. Could be like, man, we've been working and working and working and working with this kid, and they've made huge progress, and they're nowhere near leading a cell group. What are we doing wrong? It was depressing. And you have to keep. We'd come home from these, and we'd have to kind of encourage the team. Hey, let's praise God for what they're doing. It's really great stuff. Let's not get all angry. But that was a tendency, and so you have to fight it. You have to look it in the face and see it for what it is. Let's praise God for those who can move forward quicker, and pray that God would release them to really effective ministry for the kingdom and have a team heart about all the workers in the kingdom while realizing our work is got extra work to do before they can compete at that level in Christian ministry. So,
and it's also social capital is something that you're hoping will increase to the next generation if you bring that guy's family.
Absolutely.
And so, if they resent social capital, you're almost ruining them to resent their own family, maybe, or, you know, somebody that they're very close to.
Right. And so that I'm clear, it's not that they resent the social capital of the other person, that they resent feeling like they got to work three times as hard and nobody notices them, but the other person gets put on, you know, on stage and praised for what a great Christian worker they are and how they love God. That's the burn, is it's discouraging. And so it's not a resenting of it. At least I haven't seen that all that much. Well, there is...
I see it a lot with my group, with damaged women who come out from sexual abuse.
Right.
You know, and this is an inner city.
Uh-huh. But it's the same kind of issues.
It's the same kind. The social capital, the coping skills, the relational stuff,
right.
And discouraging. So that
yes.
same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But she has resented that they had normal lives.
Well, yes, I guess so that I'm clear, I have seen that is pervasive. They resent that the other person got a leg up in their mind.
Let them have a leg up and not
them. I have not seen that as much, but I have seen a little bit of that. I've just seen more just the resentment of, you know, here I am laboring away, and other people pass me like I'm standing still. And it's just, they're discouraged. And you got to keep propping them up and encouraging them. And maybe a last thing that I'll say, and I need to move off this, but here's something that I think is a challenge for us as a faith community, is as disciplers, are we biased towards going after the people with lots of social capital so we can produce those disciples and have great ministry? Because it's just flat out more fun, more exciting, and I don't know if I want to say easier, because it's still work. It's all work, and that's where, but it sure, you get rewarded so much more, so much quicker, and to go and work with the liquorheads, or to go and work with, because you know what, your point is really well made. This is really this model and these concepts have less to do with just inner city and more have to do with brokenness in people across all spectrums. It's just in the inner city you see higher concentration of these kind of people. Exactly. There's more issues, right? But with every person, they net out somewhere on each of those scales. It's just that certain geographical areas tend to net out higher on many of them, and therefore it takes less work because you have less of a deficit. Right, right.
Well, you can see it. You can gauge that right here, how many people attended here. Percentage-wise, how many people are going somewhere else.
Well, and the only thing I would say to that is I think we win by not condemning anyone, but rather by raising the virtue and extolling the virtue of reaching out to broken people. And the fact that that's how we combat that. I think, again, that's a slippery slope, because if you get too cynical about that,
right,
it doesn't help anything, but it will get you sour inside.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the human nature is, how much effort is this going to take? How long is it going to take me to see a result? Let's go over here. I can reach out to this guy and tutor him math, because he's just having a little math problem. Other than that, he's
right. And here's where that's right on one level of strategy. If I've only got so much time to make ministry happen in my life, I want to be strategic. Here's where it's wrong. You'll never pierce the homogenous people group you're within, or pierce the ones outside of that group, if you're not willing to do this. Because this is the kind of stuff it takes to get into the areas of the city and to get into populations that nobody's being effective in, and to raise leaders within those populations who will then take... And so, Paul, for example, if you read Corinthians and you see all the miserable discouragement he had to put up with those guys, okay, or Galatians, or all the other churches, there's very few churches you read Paul, you're like, man, if I was him and I planted 15 churches and that was my life work, and then I was writing letters, you know, kick the man out that's sleeping with his dad's wife, I really am an apostle, those guys telling you that I'm not, that's a problem, you know. How discouraging would that be? But in spite of all the craziness, he pierced all these different cultures. So he put up with all this crap, but he planted the church in all these disparate people groups, which then produced a harvest over time that I think would outstrip the work of Peter, if I can even go that far, who worked exclusively with the Jews. And we don't really see some massive movement of Jewish Christians that turned the world upside down. It was those crazy knuckleheads that Paul saved from all over these other people groups that did it. So, anyway, I got to make tracks here. I already see one class is out, so I'm going to try to ramp up. Dominant culture versus minority culture issues. The other thing you got to realize is that many of these people have social capital in their minority culture. It's not that they don't have social capital, they don't have the right kind. And those of us who live in the dominant culture are socialized into it. And so we have to teach them to be bicultural. So that's another hurdle that they have to go through. And so that's another issue that you have to be at least aware of, and how much of your cultural concerns are legitimate. I'll give you one example. I was at a conference. It was sponsored by Youth for Christ, I hate to say. And I had a bunch of kids with me from the city, and they're all wearing their crack drawers. This was a couple years ago when it was really fashionable. It's kind of going out a little bit more now, but you still see it, where they had like pants down to here. And every kid I've ever seen, with one exception, wear, you know, boxer shorts or something underneath it. So you're not looking at butt, you're just looking at another layer of clothing, right? So frankly, it's not really exposing anything. The one exception was an unfortunate feller that sat on our upholstered couch, so that was a problem. But there's a woman up at this conference talking about how disrespectful it is for these guys that walk around with their pants sagging down and exposing all of us to have to look at that. Meanwhile, this chick had cleavage like, phew, way down there. She had on pants that were so tight you could see her underwear lines. You know, it was just like, blah. But the way she was dressed was socially acceptable for dominant culture. And what she was criticizing was actually a bunch of kids that if you just looked at the two of them side by side, you'd be like, well, they're probably really way more appropriate than she is. But not one person had a problem with what she was saying. That's a minority culture versus dominant culture issue. And you get into that kind of stuff with people in when you're going to raise a leader, you got to think through, what is it that you're trying to get into with them and challenge them on and challenge them to grow through. If I got a kid with crack drawers, he needs to pull them up to go out for a job interview, because the job interview is going to take place in dominant culture. And if he doesn't learn the skill on how to show up presentable in dominant culture, he ain't going to be able to compete for good jobs. On the other hand, if I teach him that his minority culture is wrong and it's a moral issue, he's embarrassing me and him in the name of Jesus by wearing his crack drawers, then he will come back to the city and the other kids will look at him like he's a dork. And therefore, his influence in that culture will drop. We've got to think these things through. And then come back to this question, so do we hold out for the same standard if we take all this into consideration? And my answer is yes. I think we have to hold out for the same standard. We just have to realize those who have less damage or more have had more training and support in the social aspects of their lives are blessed. And we ought to look at it that way, and they should look at it that way. But I think that we have to be careful in just dumbing down the bar. I think the church will not grow effectively if we do that. That's a challenge. I want to come back to one other thought that's related to that in a minute. Okay, so what social areas should we invest in? First of all, I want to comment on the limitations of the felt need concept. This is another one of those things that is out there in urban work. Felt need, that's where you come into a community, decide what is the community is feeling a need for, and then that's what you kind of start at. I look at that as kind of the worm on the hook. Okay, felt needs are a great thing to get you into a community to begin to build some relationships. But if there is no hook, you're not going to get very far. I know a lot of people who have no felt need to get off a crack, or no felt need to work a full-time job. This is only a point of entry. It's not enough. We can't just speak to, and frankly, I also see people who have felt needs for things, that they're wrong on. I feel a need for more money. Is there anybody that can't say that? I feel a need to be paid more for the work I am doing. Every employee I've ever met feels that way. My boss just doesn't realize how valuable I am to this company, because if they did, they'd pay me more. Okay? Everybody feels that way. Felt needs have a place, but they're not the whole concept. The approach that we have developed, some of you have sat in a seminar with me before, have probably seen this, because this is something we've been working on for years. This is our holistic community development or holistic ministry model. These are the arenas of work that we feel that God's called us to be part of in urban work. If you look at the handout that I gave you, it details outcome areas for each of these five subdomains. You'll see the relational context on the outside speaks to my concern that it's relationship that is the core issue. Therefore, rebuilding relational wholeness is one of the core solutions, and it ought to permeate everything that we do. Relationship with God, relationship with others, relationship with family. Those are critical skill-building areas that, in the inner city, we need to be experts at. And then, again, spiritual and moral, that's kind of our roots, evangelism, discipleship, economic. And for me, if I don't view poverty as the primary issue, I would even go out on a limb in many people's minds and say, I don't think most people in my neighborhood are poor, and I live in the low socioeconomic neighborhood in this city. So I think that, therefore, implies I'm saying there really isn't extreme poverty in our city for the most part. That on an individual person-by-person situation, you may find that, but if you consider what poverty is by a historical perspective, by a global perspective, or by a biblical perspective, very few people in my neighborhood are poor. And if you want some reinforcement on that, talk to any missionary that's come back from overseas in a third world country. There's also a report out by a think tank in D.C. that compared the average lifestyle of people below the poverty level in America today that demonstrated that the average person that we call poor in America today has a lifestyle equivalent of someone who was middle class in the 70s. Same number of cars, same number of rooms in their house, air conditioning, TV, two-car garage, whatever. But by comparing what people have in their daily lifestyle, their report says our standard for what poverty is keeps going up. And what I'm saying is I don't think it's a poverty issue. So for us, economic literacy is not about they're poor. It's about how they handle their money. Are they good stewards of what they have? And how are they advancing in their ability to make money through a career? Are they thriving in the opportunity, the economic system that they're in? Education, self-explanatory. I think basic health and safety, I've covered the basic concept there. Civic literacy is a little more vague, but what I'm talking about in that arena is their capacity to interact with the community around them and feel part of a community instead of all on their own, completely alienated from everyone. Do they know how to relate to people? Can they make a decision to do something that's better for the group, even if it's not better for them? Many kids don't have that capacity. If it ain't good for me, then it's done. And they don't know how to be part of a community. Again, this is detailed in that paper. I'm not going to spend too much more time in it, but I would encourage you to at least to read through that. And that paper that I handed out, by the way, is a version that I developed for a focus group of pastors. So it's got some opening material that was written for that reason, and I need to rewrite it just for a generic use like this, and I haven't yet. So please overlook that introduction. Okay. What equipping plans exist to help these social areas? If you want to raise leaders and you have no plan, no skills, no background in any of those areas other than you know your Bible, what are you going to do about the economic issues? I'll bet if you're this woman that you're talking about, I'll bet you it took you into trails and challenges and problems that you've never had to sort through before. And what resources do we bring as a Christian community to the table on these issues? I think we could do better as the entire Christian community at equipping our workers, our Christian workers, in some of these areas. Do you have access to the resources that you need for this person? And frankly, will you do the extra work to get them if you don't? Because this is where a lot of people bottom out. They're just like, you know, I told him to get another job and he didn't. So I just don't think he's committed to being a disciple. And so I'm moving on. And I'm not saying that isn't warranted at times. But I'm saying that that's not always the issue. Okay, what impact will social deficits have on realistic expectations for rate of growth? This is another piece to this. This is how we typically imagine character change over time. It's pretty linear. I'm going to suggest to you that it's more like this. I think that when someone becomes a Christian, there's a burst of energy and they begin to deal with some of their issues, but then they kind of pace out on a pretty slow level. And I would say, and I didn't draw this maybe very well, but this is kind of an exponential curve. In other words, the more they grow, the faster they grow. And let me give you one illustration of that. Okay? How about this person that I'm trying to get to read spiritual books so they can grow? They're, as a brand new Christian, they don't know how to read. So I got to explain things to them. And then I'm going to start reading to them. I get them to, okay, why don't you join this group or get together with me on a regular basis and I can read some things to you because you can't read. That's a problem. And then I'm going to work on teaching you to read or get you into a reading program. And gosh, that's going to take a long time to the point you can actually read on your own. And then maybe we'll start reading some books together, okay? And then I'm going to have you, like, read the book on your own and just come and discuss the content with me. And then I can hand you a reading list. Now, think about it this way. If you're at a place where I could just hand you a reading list and you'd go read all that stuff and come back and you'd understand it, how much more rapidly are you going to grow spiritually than down here if you can't read and you just have to have people explain things to them? And that's the way a lot of these things work. And so this is the challenge of urban ministry right there. We all want to have people that are there. But the preponderance of the people we find are not on a whole number of scales. And so we have to be patient. We have to be committed and consistent. I've talked about the special challenge of relational deficits enough, I think, but that's, to me, a big challenge. So in summary, it's like that. Got to get to work, and one person comes out and that's what they inherit in the morning, and the other person comes out and they inherit that. And if our model for raising leaders is kind of geared around people that have that going for them, we're really going to struggle with this. We just have to rethink what we're dealing with are people that have that problem. All right, now let me go through a couple real quick practical things. Hopefully all of you are doing some form of urban work and these will be helpful to you. Number one, transparency is a foundation. If I were to make a list of all the things that you're going to face in working with urban people, drug addiction, alcohol abuse, beating their wife, doesn't have a job or has a low-paying job, didn't finish high school, and on and on the list goes. What's the most important thing that we address first? Well, from our experience, it's this: honesty and transparency. You've got a person with this package of problems who's lying to you, which is typically what they do because they're so used to do-gooders coming into their life trying to fix them, and they don't want to show themselves as bad off as they are. I mean, they have an intuitive sense that other people are better off than them, and so they typically lie all the time about stuff that's really happening in their life. And you can't disciple with somebody when they're lying to you all the time. Because you, whatever plan that you're making to help them with stuff is going to fall apart because it's based on some premises that aren't really true. So in our leadership development programming, stage one in our program is a contract of, and an agreement that you will be honest with me, and that's a critical thing. My commitment to you is to not judge you and to not react to you and throw you out because you were honest with me. Your commitment is you got to be honest. The biggest cardinal sin you can make is to lie to me in our discipling relationship. And that's got to be a conversation that happens at the front end, and it needs to be reinforced. If you don't do that, you're going to spin lots of wheels. So we have. So that was an aha that came after a couple years of wheel spinning. That, you know, what is the problem? The problem is we're constantly finding out about, you know, this kid coming to our group that's sleeping with this chick over here, and everybody in the group knows it but me. And they're all lying. And then the second one that goes with that is get the kids who are growing in leadership or the young adults that are growing in leadership to stop having each other's back on their lies, because that's cultural. Second, setting behavioral boundaries. I guess let me go back.
So how do you deal with that?
You have to, in your leadership development time and your discipleship with that leader, you have to talk through over and over and over again how leading a double life will never get you to where you want to go. That talking about all these other things, if you're lying to me about what's really going on, is a big waste of your time and mine. And, you know, kids are into the word authentic. You're not being authentic. And you just, you're not going to win that conversation overnight. But you make it, and you make it, and you make it. You show them grace when they screw up. You woo them into...
Well, I'm sleeping with this girl, and I'm going to continue sleeping with her. What do you say?
I would say, if that's what you said to me, thank you for being honest with me. That's really helpful, and that at least gives us a conversation about how you can grow as a disciple. You realize that as long as you're sleeping with her, that's going to be a huge barrier to you being able to be a walking disciple, and God's probably going to be convicting you about that. What do you think about that?
I like it.
Okay, well.
God made me this way, and mm-hmm. That's how I am.
Right. So that's going to be a barrier for you.
And then what do you do?
What do I do?
It depends on
a lot of circumstances, but it's not a slam dunk that I'm going to throw them out of my group. And in most cases, probably not. But it depends. Like, I have one kid we just polarized out at age 22.
If he did, my personal thing was, well, you're wrong next to me. I ain't calling him.
Right.
He threw him out. Mm-hmm. I can help that.
Right. We just polarized a kid out of our group. He's under discipline because he's been sleeping with his girlfriend on the side, keeping it secret. He's been in a leadership development program for 6 or 7 years, and he's been celibate for the last 3 or 4. He's matured a ton. He knows what he's doing's wrong. He knows keeping his secret's wrong. He knows that, and he has the maturity and capacity to not do it. He just wants to. That kid's under discipline. That same kid was screwing around a lot when he first came around, and we loved him and encouraged him and loved him and encouraged him, and eventually he stopped. So, but at that point, he was too immature to make the right decision. What he needed was grace, and what he needed was encouragement to continue to be honest and to be honest about the struggle of why he didn't want to, and the constant grace-oriented approach of saying, now you realize this is really going to be a barrier to you walking with God. And then when it came time for other kids to step up to other levels of leadership, and we wouldn't let him up because of his choices, suddenly he started feeling the pinch. And then he chose to stop. But now that he's been stopped, and he's gone back to it, and he is mature enough to understand it, we had a sit-down talk with him, and we kind of booted him out. And you know what? There wasn't even a fight. He knew it. And I think over the long haul, he'll be back. We'll win him back. It is a struggle. But I think there's no one-size-fits-all answer to that because, and I want to go back to the beginning, unlike some people would say, well, you just can't have somebody sleeping around in your group, period. Throw him out. Sorry. Yeah. Not in this population.
And I can have him. On the other side of that, I can say, well, wait a second. We are here to judge. That's between him and God. Or now you just threw him at back to the pack of wolves. They could have that.
Right. We could talk about this for a long time. I'll cite the fact that Paul threw a couple people out of the church to be disciplined by Satan. 1 Thessalonians. I'm trying to think of the name of the guys that he threw out. He also encouraged the church in 1 Corinthians 5 to throw out the man that was sleeping with his dad's wife. And later on in 2 Corinthians, we believe he's the one that Paul encourages them to receive back as repentant. So I think there's a place for that, depending on the issue. Again, this is where wisdom, as opposed to hard and fast rules, begins to overrule or to rule in discipleship and leadership development. Is you got to take into account how mature the person is, what other issues there are in their life. Frankly, if the kid's carrying a gun and shooting people, maybe sleeping around isn't the thing I'm going to be working on. So that all those things have to be taken into consideration. And that's where, if you don't have a stomach for that, you probably can't do this kind of work. Because if you're thinking that you're just going to ride in and tell everybody no sleeping around ever in a group of urban anybodies, you'll have no disciples real quick except people who can't get laid, and that's, you know, hardly any of them. So you got to start where they're at and then draw them forward.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.